And well, if timing is everything, we're good. With the excitement of the World Baseball Classic, the MLB season a week away, let's talk some baseball. Our guest has authored a spectacular book about the 1973 season called The Greatest Summer in Baseball History. It was the first year of the DH, last year for Willie Mays, the boss buys the Yankees. Very pleased to have John Rosengren on. Hey, John, great having you. How's life in the Twin Cities?
Hi, Steve. The sun is shining this afternoon in the Twin Cities, so I'm happy.
Well, it's not shining here, so I will live vicariously. But, John, I've been doing this show about 30 years, and whenever I have an author on, my first question is, so you decided to, you know, it's an undertaking to write a book. In this case, it just looks like a substantial effort. My first question is basic. What was the inspiration for you decide to do this and this subject in particular?
Well, I'd already done several books already, but I hadn't written one about baseball. And I grew up loving baseball. And I was looking for a season that I could chronicle, one where some significant events had occurred and also when it was an interesting time in the nation. And I found that in the 1973 season, as you mentioned, there are those significant events that occurred, the designated hitter rule, the boss buying the Yankees, that brought the infusion of big money into the game. And then Hank Aaron was chasing Babe Ruth's venerable 714 mark, and the Mets played the A's in the World Series, and there's a passing of the torch of superstars from Willie Mays to Reggie Jackson, and all those things seem to line up, you know, and against the backdrop of the Watergate hearings that brought down Richard Nixon, and they right before they interrupted Game 5 of the National League playoff series to announce Spiro Tiagnu's resignation.
Right.
So it was a wild time both in the nation and on the baseball diamond, and I wanted to chronicle that.
Well. Excellent. It's really enjoyable. Talking with John Rosengren, author of this outstanding book. Of course, Hank Aaron put the chase for Babe Ruth on the front pages. It was his last 40-homer season. It would pull him within one of the iconic 714. But, of course, your chapter tells what part of an awful story of the mail, and I'm not sure many know, so if you would elaborate, explain how he first hid all the vitriol and hate, but eventually felt he had to go public.
Right, so it's important to remember this is 1973, so we're just very recently removed from the Jim Crow era, and the civil rights movement has been in effect for a decade, but there's still a strong sentiment of racism in the United States. And Babe Ruth, of course, is this beloved white man, and his mark is the most famous record perhaps in all of sports. And so to see a black man going after that rankled some people. And you mentioned the mail. Henry Aaron received more mail than anybody else in the country that year, except for President Nixon. He had some 930,000 pieces of mail delivered during the course of the year, and about a third of those were negative, and they had some ugly racial epithets, even death threats in there directed at him and his family. And so he lived that summer under enormous pressure. I mean, just what he was doing on the baseball field, you know, chasing this record, made him what Newsweek called the most conspicuous figure in sports, in all of sport, not just baseball. But then to be doing it, under the threat of death, if he just simply did his job, made it that much harder for him. And so, as you can imagine, it was a very difficult season, and yet he bore with that pressure with, I think, a grace and dignity that really sets him apart and as a hero for all time.
And, of course, it's ironic now that it's MLB-wide, but that year, 50 years ago, the American League inserted something called the designated hitter. And being a Yankees fan, I remember Ron Bloomberg, you know, walked as the first DH. But as you wrote, John, this was not a beloved idea all around. As A, it was pitched by the Oakland A's polarizing owner, Charles Finley. So what were the big concerns or kind of, I guess, the roadblocks people like the Dodgers' Walter O'Malley tried to put up?
Right. Well, as we're seeing today with the new rule changes being implemented for the 2023 season, change itself is difficult, especially for baseball purists. So there was that group that just didn't want anything to change. And Charlie O'Finley, as you mentioned, he was reviled by others. He came up with this idea, let's have a permanent pinch hitter. And Walter O'Malley opposed it simply because Finley had proposed it. But the argument for it was that baseball was in tough straits at the time. There had been a strike in 1972, and then in 73 the owners had locked out the players as they bartered over a new basic agreement. So there was this, and the fans were not sympathetic to these labor disputes on either side, really.
Sure.
And so they'd soured on the game, and the attendance was down, and the owners thought they needed to do something to rescue it. And while they couldn't be swayed in the National League because of Walter O'Malley, in the American League, they decided to try this experiment for 3 years and to see if they could, you know, how it would impact the game. So they implemented the designated hitter in 73, and it worked. It created more hits, more runs, more home runs, more excitement, and most importantly, more fans. The American League set an attendance record in 73, in large part due to the designated hitter. And there were also some tight division races that added excitement. But it was deemed such a success that the owners voted. They'd initially decided to try it for 3 years as an experiment. Well, it was such a success they decided to make it permanent after that first season.
And lo and behold, here we are. And you mentioned the pennant races. Someone who was living in the shadow of New York, the Mets were 4 years removed from the miracle of 1969, had that great pitching, and they won one of the ugliest division races ever. They won 83 games, and they beat the, I guess you would say, the budding Big Red Machine in the League Championship Series, and then that legendary retirement speech during the middle of the year from Willie Mays. But what to elaborate what you wrote about there, you gotta believe run to the World Series under Yogi Berra is really a fascinating story.
You know, I agree. Just that, the story of the Mets through 73 was amazing. To borrow that word that's so often tagged, they're tagged. But they, as you said, they were in last place on August 30th, and they and it seemed like nobody wanted to win the division because like barely anybody could get to 500. But the Mets made a run for it, and Tug McGraw, you know, behind first Yogi Berra said it was the the famous "It ain't over till it's over," and then Tug McGraw is leading rallying them with the "You Gotta Believe" cry. And sure enough, they win the division. They go to that playoff series against the Reds, and it goes five games. And, you know, that's when Pete Rose took out Woody Harrelson, and Woody came up swinging. And or Bud Harrelson, sorry, not Woody Harrelson. I'm mixing up my Harrelsons here. But, no, yeah, so, you know, Bud Harrelson and Pete Rose are going at it. And then the Mets make it to the World Series. And here's something so amazing is Willie Mays was on a – just running on fumes at that point. He was certainly the best player of a generation, maybe of all time, if I could win that argument against those who believe Babe Ruth is. But here he is at the end of his career, and it's just painful to watch. He's stumbling around the bases. He's not tracking fly balls in the outfield. You know, things that were once routine for him, he's having trouble with. But he won he had the game-winning hit in Game 5 of that playoff series, the National League playoff series. And then he's on the goes into the World Series, and you know people are thinking maybe he can come through again. Maybe there's a little bit magic left in that old bat. But I'll leave it to the readers to read and find out how it turns out. but anyway, it was and then a very dramatic speech when he says, you know, it's time to say goodbye to America at the end of it was late September. Where he spoke at Shea Stadium. But it was just, I think, a riveting time for Mets fans. The Metsomania had gripped Met City, as they called it.
Oh, yeah. No, as a 12-year-old growing up in the shadow, like I said, it might have been a half century ago. I could recite it like it was yesterday. Talking with John Rosengren, this amazing book about the 1973 season, the greatest summer in baseball history. So we know that across the other side of the country, the A's were the defending champs. They had the cast of characters, Reggie, Catfish. But, John, a lesser-known story is that Reggie had missed the 72 World Series with a hamstring injury. He hurt it again. What could you share about the controversy between the owner, Charles Finley, and the manager, Dick Williams, about what to do or when to get Reggie back in the lineup?
Well, right, there was the, Reggie scored, I think, the tying run in the American League Championship Series in 72, but in doing so, he tore his hamstring, and so he was out. And then he tweaked it again during the 73 season, and there was controversy as to whether or not to keep him in. And the way Charlie Finley worked was he would tell Dick Williams, the manager, what to do, and much to Williams, hurt Williams' pride. It hurt his ability to really run the team, manage the team, and be effective. And it got so bad that during the 73 World Series, Finley pulled the stunt where he made the second baseman had made a couple errors late in the game that cost the A's some runs, and so the Mets ended up winning the game. And Finley made the second baseman, he bullied him into signing a statement written by the doctor saying there was a problem with his shoulder.
Right.
There was nothing wrong with the guy's shoulder. Williams, that was the final straw for Williams, and he told the team, I'm done. I mean, this is in the middle of the World Series. He tells his players, I'm done. And he says, if this leaks to the press, I'm going to deny it till the series is over, but I'm finished. I can no longer work for this man. I mean, that's how bad it got, and that was the level of tension on the team. And, of course, Reggie Jackson had no issues with speaking out and blasting Finley in the press. And he organized a protest where the next day they wore the second baseman's number 17 on their in black armbands after he'd been sent home. And the guy's name was Mike Andrews.
Yep.
And they called it the Andrews affair.
It was crazy. Now, full transparency, Reggie's my all-time favorite player, and when he became a Yankee, I lost my mind. But that World Series, Mets-A's, you know, it was a mismatch on paper, kind of like 69 against the Orioles. You got a 3-2 Mets lead, Game 6, Catfish Hunter out-dueled Tom Seaver, and Game 7, you know, your chapter titled A Classic Fall Classic. And while folks think of the greatest World Series ever, you know, Reds, Red Sox in 75, or for you, Twins, Braves in 91, but how unique and dramatic what was that Fall Classic 50 years ago?
Well, exactly. You have these two very colorful teams, and they go seven games. And that's what we love about baseball, right? Anything can happen. It was a mismatch on paper, but and the A's should have won in four straight, but they didn't. And it went to Game 7. And, you know, before Game 6, Reggie had said, guys, basically, you know, I'm going to carry you. And he hadn't been backing up his hype to that point, but he sure came through in Game 6, Game 7. He turned out to be the MVP of the World Series. And then on the other side, Yogi Berra, the manager of the Mets, started Tom Seaver on 3 days rest for Game 6, got widely criticized for that. You know, as you said, Hunter outdueled him. And Game 6 with the Mets leading the series 3-2 was not a must-win for the Mets. Berra could have saved Seaver till Game 7. You know, I bet he wished afterward he had. But he put him in there, and Seaver wasn't up to it, and so they had to go to a Game 7. Anyway, it was just a fascinating series. And, you know, those are just the highlights. There's so much more there. But unless I just read the book to everybody.
Yeah, don't do that.
I can't tell them everything right now.
No, the bottom line is I remember vividly the fans were clamoring for a junk-balling lefty named George Stone to start Game 6 back then. Lastly, I've got to get a little personal here. When a shipbuilder named George Steinbrenner purchased the Yankees for just over $10 million, funny, this week they were valued at $7 billion. It really wasn't headline news outside of New York. You know, that was the year the Twin Towers opened, and the Yankees incredibly had lost money the year before. But in researching this chapter, John, what stood out about the boss buying this iconic franchise and the ripple effect? Because it turned out to be pretty impactful.
Well, exactly, because Yankees had been they'd been losing games and losing money significantly since CBS had bought them. And so in 72, I think they lost 76 games and $1 million. And CBS had bought them in 64 for $13.2 million. Steinbrenner got them for $10 million. And actually, after the accounting was all done, when CBS bought back a few parking garages, Steinbrenner bought the Yankees for $8.7 million. I mean, don't you wish you'd been able to get in on that deal? Kind of like buying Apple stock or when it was first issued or something. But he came in and, you know, he said famously, "I'm going to stick to building ships," but he just could not help but meddle. And, you know, in spring training, he gave Ralph Houk, the manager, a list of players who needed haircuts. And he also started, which, you know, showed how he was going to be involved during the year. That wasn't building ships. And he also made them, by the time the season started, the highest. They had the highest payroll in baseball, and of course that would just continue to inflate when he signed Catfish Hunter as the first free agent to a whopping like $3.5 million at the time. Right. And so that was the beginning of Steinbrenner, you know, putting his fingerprints all over that team and, you know, spending big money. And love him or hate him, you know, he did restore them to their former glory.
And they are worth $7 billion. Unbelievable. Folks, I could talk for days, but in radio, John, we actually have to take breaks. This is John Rosengren. The book, The Greatest Summer in Baseball History, the story of the 1973 season. John, this has been great fun for me, the memories of a 12-year-old. Congrats. Best of luck on the book. Wishing you and your family well. And I'd love to talk again down the road, but thanks so much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Steve. I'd love to reminisce some more with you, but I appreciate the chance to chat some baseball with you.
All right. Be well. Take care. There you go.